Well, you do have a book, do you not, in your worship guides, and you should be terrified because it's Communion Sunday and you're thinking, holy mackerel, I might be here till baseball season actually starts, and so that kind of thing. But I promise you, I'll explain why that is, but you should pull that out right now, that part that says, who are you, and open up your Bibles to the book of Ephesians. Ephesians. Written to a city called Ephesus, which is why they call it Ephesians. Not very creative, actually, but that's the way that works out in the Bible. And this morning, what I'd like to do is lay a foundation of a historical kind of understanding of Ephesus and the book of Ephesians. I'd like to talk a little bit about culture. Now, culture is a broad term that refers to kind of the religious practices, the business practices, the arts, and the different aspects of passion that existed in a culture, the daily lives that people live. Those are all contributors to the culture. Now, even the physical area where someone lives, like we live in Southern California, close to the ocean. And so we have a certain culture that adapts to that, which is different, let's say, than from somebody that's up in Minnesota right now who couldn't get out their front door because of the weather, that kind of thing. So we have different cultural realities that exist. And my goal this morning is to give you a historical and cultural introduction to the book of Ephesians, so that we can have a better understanding of why the Apostle Paul, the author of this letter that he wrote to the church that existed in Ephesus, so that we can understand better why he wrote the things that he wrote. Why were they important? And even more significantly, I want you to listen. I want you to listen carefully for how the city of Ephesus and the city that we live in, this kind of metropolis of Long Beach, Cypress, LaSalle, Lakewood, if I missed your city, I apologize, that kind of thing. This area that we live in, what the parallels are to who we are. So let's dive in. I am not going to read all of this to you, okay? You guys know somebody joked, Juliet joked with me this morning, oh great, you haven't preached for 3 weeks and now we get a 7-page outline and that kind of thing. We need to keep you up there so that you don't do this kind of thing. But what I'd like to do is just, if you grab that packet, the last, probably the center pages have got, there's a map of Ephesus, or it's actually a map of Asia Minor, and you can see Ephesus on the coast kind of right in the middle of Asia Minor, just above Miletus and below Smyrna. That is where Ephesus is. I'll give you a second. I hear a lot of papers. It's not that big. Come on, people. And then there's a artfully recreated city of Ephesus. And probably the thing that will locate you the best in the whole city of Ephesus is the harbor, which is on the left of that map. It's on the left of what's going on there, and it's labeled, I can't read that right now, but it's labeled, I promise you, and it's where the ships are, right there on the left, and you'll see a road that leads right out of the harbor that leads to the great theater that is in the center of the city. That kind of will locate you, that will help you to understand what's going on. From the harbor, there's a long road called the Arcadian Way, which led through the center of the city. The main marketplace is right off to the side of that. It led right to the Great Theater. And from the Great Theater, you could wander out to some of the temples that were in town, the most significant of which we're going to talk about in just one second. The city of Ephesus was about 250,000 people. It was the most significant city in Asia Minor. It really was the city that was the primary place of the development of culture for the region, for all of Asia Minor. It functioned in a lot of ways the way that Paris or London does for the world, the way that New York City and Los Angeles do for the United States, probably more New York City, frankly, than Los Angeles. But it had a cultural tone to it. It had distribution of the culture to the rest of Asia Minor. So whatever happened in Ephesus would happen in other places. This wasn't Vegas, right? It didn't stay there. It went from there and went to the rest of the world, actually much like Vegas. The establishment of the city really got going in about 550 BC. Now, by BC, I mean, you know, I use that in the simple way, before Christ, right? AD, which doesn't stand for after Christ, Anno Domini, means after the death of Jesus Christ or after the birth of Jesus Christ, the Christ's life. That's how we kind of divide our timetables and that kind of thing. So 550 years or so before Christ was even born, Ephesus got going. And it moves around a little bit right at the beginning, but when the sea harbor is established on the Aegean Sea in 375, that is when the city really begins to take off. Because having a harbor allowed for ships to come in and bring goods, and it also allowed for the people that were in Ephesus to share their goods with the rest of the world. And so we begin to have a confluence or a coming together of the city and the culture and the harbor, and Ephesus literally explodes. At this time, the temple of Artemis, right when the harbor is open, there's an old temple dedicated to the god Artemis, or Diana, a Greek god. She was a Greek god of fertility. Her entire body, as you can see from the picture down in the lower right-hand corner, her entire body is covered with breasts. That is so gross to me. I've got a comment. I'm going to keep it to myself, but it's kind of creepy. This whole, like, surrounded by breast thing. And then on her body as well are different animals. There's birds and there's stags. There's all kinds of different animals. And so she was a goddess of animals and fertility. And you can understand in an ancient culture why that was so important. They needed those animals to function in their culture. It was what produced money for them on a lot of levels. And fertility was an important issue because in order to have children, you wanted to make sure that you were actually able to and fertile. And infertility and miscarriages were a huge issue in the ancient world. The mortality rate of children was very, very low. And because of that, they did a lot of sacrificing and a lot of worship to fertility goddesses and to fertility gods as well. And you should know that in Ephesus, the way that they did that was they would go to the temple and the men would sleep with the fertility goddess prostitutes. And that's how they became more fertile, which we know actually doesn't work, but it was very popular in this culture, which was maybe just a touch more primitive than our own. And that was the way, one of the ways they worshiped specifically for fertility. Well, around 323, not too long after the original temple got burnt down, they began to build what would turn out to be one of the most spectacular temples in all of the ancient world. The Temple of Artemis, this temple to Diana, this temple to the goddess of animals and fertility and a few other random things that we'll learn about in weeks ahead, was 450 feet long. Wow. Think about that. A football field's 300 feet long. This temple was 450 feet long, 225 feet wide, and 60 feet high with 130 gigantic columns that held up the 60-foot roof. Compare that. I mean, imagine this, right? That is a structure in the ancient world built by hands and people with hand tools. That's it. That's all they had. Hand tools and the ability to move these stones into place and this kind of thing. They did all of that in the ancient world. This is a structure that is about, just to put it into our context here, it's about half the size of the Queen Mary. Think about how big the Queen Mary is. And this thing was about half of that. It's just extraordinary how large this structure was and how spectacular. In fact, it was one of the, you've probably heard of the seven wonders of the ancient world. The seven wonders of the world, this was one of them. The temple to Artemis in Ephesus is one of the Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, coined that way by a poet who walked through and said, this is more extraordinary than the library at Alexandria, more extraordinary than the gardens in Babylon. This thing is off the hook, basically. It is an amazing, amazing temple. There was a statue that was out in front of it of Artemis, and there was a statue that is also on the inside of it, which you can see in the cutaway. If you carefully look down, you can see another idol in there. And these idols were venerated. They were worshipped in that culture. People would put all kinds of things around them. The temple employed a 1,000 priests, artisans, temple prostitutes. It was the center of the culture in Ephesus and in all of Asia Minor, which, by the way, Asia Minor is modern-day Turkey, Macedonia, that area that we are familiar with today. As the fame of this temple spread, so did legends. I'm down in letter F, by the way. So did the legends that were attached to it. There were festivals, the Artemis Mission festival that went through the city, and citizens would worship and cry out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." That is recorded even in Acts chapter 19, verse 28. Another legend asserted that this large idol of Artemis that was inside of the temple, and it was written about, you know, obviously we don't have any pictures or anything like that, but it was a jet black stone, 6-7 feet in height, all black, and it appeared, as you see that idol there on the right, they would make the idols as copies of the original, and it appeared, they said it fell out of the sky, and it appeared this way originally. This is what it looked like when we found it, kind of thing. Like, no human hands have carved this kind of thing. Do you recall when Paul criticized the Ephesians in the book of Acts? He criticized them for worshiping an idol that was carved by human hands. And what did the city magistrate, the guy that came out and calmed the crowd down, what did he say? It's okay. He's criticizing something that is not true of us, because the idol to Artemis was not made with human hands. So we're not doing what he's talking about. So don't worry about it. Everybody calm down. Everybody go home. That kind of thing. They believed that this idol, as it were, fell from the sky and looked just like this. Meteors were often worshipped in the ancient culture, and because of the way that it is described, it probably was a meteor that was actually carved in the form of Artemis and justified in the locals' minds the worship of Artemis. I'm moving on to letter H, just to move you forward. I know that because of the way this thing is constructed, it might be confusing as to where you're headed. It's the picture of the theater. I'm listening. I haven't just phased out. I can tell when you get there. Oh, stop it. Come on. I heard that. Everybody's starting. All right, we're moving on. The episode in Acts 19 involves Demetrius. Some of you know the story, or you can read it from Acts 19 of Demetrius and the local silversmiths. And they were hostile towards Paul, and they started a huge ruckus, and it was taken to the Great Theater. And there's a picture of the Great Theater. It's still there today. You can see off in the distance on this picture, that's where the harbor is. The harbor is actually now 5 miles away from the ancient city of Ephesus because of the silt that filled in to the harbor. You know, you have to regularly dredge a harbor because of the silt that will settle into it. And they didn't have the ability or the technology to properly empty out all the silt. And so the harbor slowly moved away from Ephesus and currently is 5 to 6 miles away where there's an established harbor that they can get the silt out of and that kind of thing. So Ephesus is actually now inland, 5 miles, a very, very long way. But you can see from where the harbor used to be, you can see the Arcadian Road that leads right to this great theater in Ephesus, another wonder of the ancient world, seating capacity of 24,000 to 25,000 people. Most of the lower rows were made of marble, where the aristocrats would sit, 66 rows of seating, 3 tiers, 22 staircases, 164 feet around. This is a gigantic theater, and I know you can't see them in the picture that I have provided, but there are actually people standing in this picture that are so tiny you can hardly even, that you can hardly even see them. This is in the city of Ephesus. This is where they drew Paul to have this kind of public argument over whether or not Paul was ruining the economy of the locals. Now, how could Paul do that? This is how Paul could do that. He would criticize, he would reveal who Jesus Christ was, criticize the local worship of something that was not making any difference in the culture. It was actually doing them damage. They were actually ruining marriages, ruining their lives, ruining all kinds of things with the local practices that were going on to the in the temple of Artemis. And what happened was he would come in and declare that Jesus Christ had come, had lived, had died for their sins, had forgiven them. And you know what they would stop doing? They would stop going to the local marketplace and buying little silver idols that would be presented to Artemis. Those silver idols were melted down by the priests and turned into money. And that was the way that people kind of gave in the ancient world. They would take precious stones, precious gold and silver, and they would have idols made out of them. And then they would worship with those idols. And then the priesthood was in charge of taking that money, reconstituting it into coinage, which they would stamp Artemis onto. And then those coins were used for the benefit of the temple. This whole system was blown apart by the Apostle Paul. And Demetrius, leading kind of what would be considered, you know, the union of silversmiths, comes up and says, I got a problem with this guy. And he starts this gigantic ruckus that goes on in Acts chapter 19. All of this is happening, by the way, right when Jesus Christ is coming to Ephesus, number 2, letter A. We're really located historically in the Bible at the end of Paul's second missionary journey. Paul probably took 4 total missionary journeys. We talk about the first 3 a lot. There was a fourth one that he dies on out in Rome. So sometimes it's not called a missionary journey, but certainly it was. And so this is in the middle of all of that. This is at the end of the second missionary journey. Paul comes to Ephesus and he goes right to the synagogue and he starts preaching about Jesus Christ. And the synagogue throws him out. And so he goes and starts preaching about Jesus Christ to the locals. And Jesus Christ kind of begins to get some foothold in the city of Ephesus. And he leaves behind a married couple, Priscilla and Aquila, who are there in the city, and they begin to establish the church. And it is not long after they begin that a person named Apollos, who came from northern Africa in the city of Alexandria, a city that would be it was like the Oxford of the ancient world. It was the Ivy League school of the ancient world was down in Alexandria. Apollos comes and powerfully preaches about the Messiah and who Jesus Christ is, and Priscilla and Aquila help him to really understand who Jesus Christ is, and they make a powerful statement for the gospel, and the gospel takes hold in Ephesus, and it kind of takes hold in the middle, in between. Like, Paul leaves after speaking in the synagogue and kind of establishing the gospel there. He leaves and he leaves Priscilla and Aquila in charge. And then Apollos comes in and really explodes the ministry. And then Paul comes back and spends a couple of years, actually 3 years of time in the city of Ephesus. He is a proponent for the gospel of Jesus Christ. He preaches the gospel consistently for 3 years. And he fights hard for the whole counsel of God. It's a key phrase. It's at the top of the back page that you're on right now, so you can flip over. The one with the footprint, the picture, you should be on the page with the picture of the footprint. He preaches the whole counsel of God. In other words, he is not interested in talking to them about one part of the gospel. He is teaching them the whole of what it means for the gospel to save you, for the gospel to grow you, and for the gospel to put you on a mission from God to move you out into the world where you can also be a person that lives and shares about Jesus Christ. He teaches the whole counsel of God. He shows how the story of the gospel exists from the very beginning of the book to the very ending of the book. It's notable in the city of Ephesus that Paul establishes it. Priscilla and Aquila begin the first church there. Apollos is one of its main teachers. When Paul leaves after his third missionary journey, who does he leave in charge? A young man named Timothy. And you know who Timothy is because you know of some of the books that are written to Timothy, the letters that Paul wrote to Timothy, asking him and encouraging him, don't let people look down on you because you're young. You're an elder in the Lord. You're a pastor in the Lord. Don't let people harass you about that. Stay true to the Word of God. Make sure that you are distinctive in teaching the whole counsel of God. He just pours that out onto Timothy. In addition to that, Onesiphorus, gosh, I have such a hard time with his name. I should probably look down and read it in letter E. Onesiphorus and Tychicus, I got him, also ministered in Ephesus. And we understand from apocryphal writing. You might have heard that word before, the Apocrypha. Those are widely distributed writings from the ancient world, but we have no ability to really root them historically. We don't know for sure that they're original stuff, and so we call it tradition. We just call it old tradition that exists in the church, and that comes through writings that just as a general kind of category are called apocryphal. They're not binding. They've got some historical value, but they shouldn't be treated in the same way as Scripture. And I try to articulate that here. They're widely circulated, but impossible to confirm their historical accuracy. But according to church tradition that was widely understood and widely embraced, the Apostle John, who wrote Revelation, who wrote the Gospel of John, that John, the Apostle John, lived to a very old age in Ephesus as kind of its overseer, apostle, and pastor after his exile to Patmos. In fact, there's good likelihood that John wrote the book of Revelation while in Ephesus towards the end of his life after his exile and was actually buried in Ephesus. And there's a large church that the Catholic Church established over the spot that they believe that John was buried. Unfortunately, the reason that we say it's not totally historically accurate is there's about 27 other locations where John has a grave and there are churches built. And so even the Catholic Church was not totally clear on where John was and where he was buried or any of that kind of stuff, which is typical of the ancient world. You got to remember, this is 2,000 years ago and it just didn't go up on the internet. It wasn't like they used headstones the same way we do. And the apostles were a very ragtag, kind of very poor financially bunch of guys. And so they, you know, it's not like their graves were fancy or anything like that. I'm going to double back to letter D just quickly to talk about Timothy real quick. There were lots of opposing teachings that went on, and I think you could pick that up from how I'm introducing the city. Do you see how religion was tied into business? Do you see the connection there? How if you wanted to be good at business, you worshiped the right gods and you did the right things and you got in the right guilds or the right unions and you connected with that and how that would affect the way that your family was established in town. All of these things were interconnected, and there wasn't just one religion to Diana. There was also the imperial cult, the Roman imperial cult. There was a temple that was built to Domitian. There was another temple later, after this book is written, that is built to Hadrian, one of the future emperors. That's going to be built in about 125 to 150 A.D. In addition to that, there are other temples to other Greek gods that existed at that time. And so Serapis was probably the most famous of those. There was a large temple built to Serapis that was also in Ephesus. And so religion was multifaceted. It was very, very, there were all kinds of different religious things. There were all kinds of different cults. The government was tied into religion, which was tied into business, which was tied into your family life, which is all of it was kind of enmeshed and interconnected. And so the tendency in the ancient world was to take religion and kind of form it or meld it into the culture that you came from. So some of the elements of your culture would leak into the religious system, and some of the elements of the religious system would leak into culture, and these two things would connect together, and they would create kind of this kind of new localized religion. And because of that, Paul writes to Timothy constantly, and he tells him, don't let that happen. Stick to the purity of the Word of God. This is the gospel that saves. Anything else will lead you to death. There's a picture down there of a single pillar. Again, there are people standing at the bottom of that, just to give you some size estimates on how large those pillars were. This is what is left of the Temple of Artemis. If you go there today, this is what you will see. One pillar that you can take a picture of. We sang this morning about how God and His ways, God and His purposes are eternal, how they last forever. I think it's a great picture of that. But I also want to note that the last time Ephesus is mentioned in the Bible is as one of the seven churches of Revelation. And what did God say? Thank you so much for fighting for the truth. Thank you that you have fought against false teachers, that you have followed that, but you've lost your love. You've lost your love for the gospel. You've lost your love for Jesus. And because you've lost your love, I just want to warn you, Jesus says, that I'll take away the light. I'll take away the lampstand that exists in your church if you don't return to the true love of the gospel and the true love of who Jesus is and what He is doing in the world. And it's sad to say that today, in the exact location, there are cities that are right around this area, the area is 99% Islamic, 99% Muslim. Once again, we live in a world where we need people that love Jesus to journey to Ephesus and share again the gospel of Jesus Christ. I don't want to miss that picture with the footprint, by the way. These are scattered around Ephesus. And this is an invitation that existed down in the harbor area to the local brothels. The prostitution that existed in Ephesus was fairly widespread. And that's essentially saying, hey, put your foot right here and keep on walking that way, and you're going to run into a brothel. And as men would come in on the ships, this was part of the culture. It was part of the accepted culture of the day and of that area. Very, very secular. Do you see parallels? Ephesus coming to Long Beach Alliance Church down there, number 3. Do you see parallels to Long Beach? The culture in Ephesus was aggressively anti-religious. They were into the religion that they were into, and they didn't want to hear from anybody else. Does that remind you of anywhere? Reminds me of Starbucks. The culture in our own area is becoming progressively more and more anti-Christian. Speak with anybody that has been a believer for the last 20 or 30 years, and they will tell you of a time when Christianity was more readily embraced. Speak to anybody that's been part of this culture for 60 or 70 years, and they will tell you that it is night and day. This culture, slowly but surely, is being boiled into being anti-Christian. Entertainment was highly important. You can tell by the size of the different theaters that existed in Ephesus and all of the money that was invested in the arts and entertainment. It was a very important industry in the ancient world, and it was hugely important in a place like Ephesus. They attracted a very ethnically diverse group of people, a varied populace. Sporting events were prized in Ephesus. Tons of money invested in stadiums, pagan religious practices. They prized their icons. They prized their staple centers, their pyramids, and all of the rest of those locations, their fabulous forums and things like that. This was their world. And I would offer up to you that it's ours as well. I would offer up to you that the very forces that were at play in Ephesus are the very forces that are at play here. Back of the back page, it's got the postcard from 1946. This is the hardest one to find. You did it. I see some of you did it. Way to go. Like Long Beach, Ephesus was a sprawling city. It was supported by a lucrative harbor. I don't know if you know this, but before World War II, Long Beach was not a very large area, but after World War II, because of the harbor, because of the number of military that were familiar with Long Beach, this area boomed. Most of you that live close to this church live in homes that were built in the post-World War II era, including myself. Most of us would even say that the last 10, 15 years have been economically difficult in this area. There has been great difficulty in staying balanced. Many of you in this room have experienced tremendous financial difficulty, and yet, even with that, the homes and the housing in our area has increased by 27%. I'm sorry, the personal salaries in our area have increased by 27%. And home prices, compared to 15 years ago, are hundreds of thousands of dollars higher than they used to be. We live in one of the most financially lucrative areas in the entire country, much like Ephesus. But everything's more expensive here, you say. Well, there's so much more to do here. There's a lot of things that take my money. Do you know how many sporting things my kids are involved with? And they all cost money. Yeah, that's exactly what the parents in Ephesus would say. That's exactly what the people in Ephesus would say. Letter C, the creature comforts which come with prosperity like in Ephesus produce. And this is a key line that I really want you to hear. It creates a very self-serving culture into which God needs to fit into our lives rather than our lives finding their identity in Jesus Christ. And I would push over to you that question. Does your life fit into God, or does God fit into your life? Does going to church fit into your schedule, or does your schedule mold around going to church? Does your life fit God in, or does your life fit into Him? In the midst of a culture which leads us towards tons of self-fulfillment, where the most popular website on the internet is a website where you can post pictures of yourself and share with people who you are, and then other people can come, some of which don't even know you, and they can look at you and look at pictures of you, and you can look at them, even though you hardly know them. And it's like a exhibitionist, voyeuristic heaven on Facebook that exists in our culture. When we live in a world of such self-fulfillment, where we rely on our own provision, where and how does God fit? How does it really work? Do you ever ask yourself, like, is God really for real? Is it really true? Like, I don't see Him anywhere. I don't feel Him anywhere. I believe that underneath 100,000 answers that Christians have, there's the nagging question of how does he really work in my life? Ephesus presses her values in against the church. The city, the culture, the world, the religion, it presses it in against the church, and the church struggled mightily. How do you respond to our culture? Do you embrace our culture, maybe in secret? Do you not let people know, but reality is you're an embracer? Do you resist it, but fail in some small area or smaller areas? Do you fight the culture? Do you scream your objections? Do you yell out from the top of the mountaintop? Turn or burn? Hold your picket sign up? You're going to hell if you don't believe John 3:16? It's an odd juxtaposition, by the way. Are you an agent for change in culture? And if so, how do you do it? The answer to these deeper issues will lead us to redefine our lives. Truly, I hear that. Hear me on that. Our answers to these issues transform us. They change us. They will redefine us. To reconsider the spiritual aspects, the war that surrounds us, the battle. Are you a soldier for the cross? How our families and our relationships are ground zero for this. And when all is said and done, at the end of your life, how you will answer this simple question. This simple question from God. Who are you? This morning we remind ourselves. We remind ourselves once again that at the center of everything we do is the cross of Jesus Christ.